Peter L. Steinke. It was my intention in inviting our three speakers for this conference to really reach out and find persons who are helpful to your ministries. And Peter Steinke has established a reputation over the past decades as one of the truly gifted caregivers to clergy and others in the Lutheran Church and in other denominations. And I was very pleased when he consented to be with us over a year ago. He is director of clergy care for Lutheran Social Services of Texas. It's kind of equivalent to our consultation to clergy here. He's an ordained Lutheran, LCMS. He has spent most of his professional life in some form or another of counseling, pastoral care to clergy and congregations. He holds advanced degrees in theology, education, and psychology. In addition to numerous invitations to conferences and workshops, he has found time to write 6 books. You may be familiar with some of them. Dealing with your discontent, defining yourself, touching others, and one that I'm sure Douglas John Hall might want to look at, preaching the theology of the cross from a pastoral care counselor. Marvelous. Good. He also edits a well-written and up-to-date clergy care newsletter called New Creation. I have a copy of it here. I note that in each of the issues, he deals in depth with some theme touching on the pastor's inner life. And I was deeply impressed with a 1987 issue entitled The Pastor Who Is Afraid to Be Real. He drew on poets like T.S. Eliot, quoting, "Humankind cannot bear very much reality." Or he would quote Ernest Becker in his Denial of Death, and he got very Lutheran with the Latin phrase, "Simul humus et clericus," at the same time human and clergy. I'm glad enough of you are catching on the standard Simul Justus phrase that we have here. And his newsletter is sprinkled with humor, too. Some of us have found his articles in the Lutheran very helpful and to the point, dealing on issues of loneliness and community. Now, I must admit, when I first read his overall theme, when Murray Bowen meets Martin Luther, my first question was, of course, who is this, Murray Bowen? Okay, I was going to do that right. I should have a little longer on Martin, okay? Well, I'm going to let Peter help us get acquainted with both of them and the dialogue, apparently, that will take place between Murray Bowen and Martin Luther. The topics are most enticing, and the first today is Adult Children of Bad Theology. We want to welcome Peter Steinke. Let's give him a warm welcome.
Well, that's coming up. I'd like to say thank you to Walt Pilgrim and to Light for the invitation to be with you. I was here on the teaching staff in August of 1989 with my family. And I knew when I left here I wanted to come back. I didn't know I would be back this soon, and I greatly appreciate being here. I have a friend who was here this summer. I think this is an apocryphal story, but he said he was taking a hike up to Holden Lake. And about halfway up, he encountered a bear. And the bear was about 50 feet away. And he got so frightened that he fell on his knees and he closed his eyes. And he said, "I almost felt like praying." And then he thought he could hear the bear coming close to him. And he kept his eyes shut. Then my friend said, the bear's paws touched him. And he was breathing heavily, and he opened his eyes. And then he was greatly relieved because he saw the bear make the sign of the cross. And then the bear started to pray, "Come, Lord Jesus, be our guest. Let these..." I think that's apocryphal. Douglas John Hall does not know this, but he is one of my theological heroes. After I had written my book, Preaching the Theology of the Cross, a number of ALC pastors from Luther Northwestern said, "Do you know the book To Lighten Our Darkness, written by Douglas John Hall?" I said, "I'd never heard of the book nor the man." And after that, I have been reading all of his books, so I greatly am pleased to be here with him and also to be able to listen to him. The first title is Adult Children of Banned Theology, but we really won't get that to my second presentation. What I'm going to be doing today is laying the groundwork for my second presentation and my third presentation. Though I'm not so sure I like the title Adult Children anymore. I had this experience, a new group of therapists got together and everybody was introducing themselves. And as is a lot of these groups, the way the first person introduces themselves, then the next person follows suit, and then the next one. And the first person said, "I'm the adult child of an alcoholic." And then the second person said, "I'm the adult child of a woman who loves too much." And then the next one said, "I'm the adult child of an abusive father." And then the next one said, "I'm the adult child of a codependent woman." And I thought, well, this doesn't fit me. What am I going to say? It was my turn. So I said, "I'm the adult child of a Missouri Synod pastor. And I'm in recovery." Now let me introduce you to Murray Bowen. In the last 30 years, there has been a group of people in a movement called Family Systems Thinking. And Dr. Murray Bowen has been the foremost theorist in this movement. He died in October of this past year. He developed 8 particular principles to describe the dynamics, the emotional occurrences in all family systems. And what I'm going to do for you now is share with you the basic Murray Bowen concept. I was introduced to this concept by a man named Edwin Friedman, who is a Jewish rabbi, has written a book called Generation to Generation, which in itself has become somewhat of a phenomenon. It's now in its 9th printing. And for the last 3 years, I have been studying with Dr. Friedman. Murray Bowen was not a particularly religious man, nor was his family. But in 1980, while he was the director of the Georgetown Family Center, he was going to introduce a 9th principle to his other 8 principles. And that 9th principle was to be spirituality. However, in 1980, he had 2 very serious surgeries. And some things changed in his life and his thinking, and he never followed up on that principle. So I'm going to tomorrow take up some of that principle, and I want to talk about how family systems theory can help us look at things in terms of spirituality. Murray Bowen was the man who in some cases picked up enemies because of the way he thought and what he produced, and he also picked up many followers. I do not think Murray Bowen has spoken the final word on how families function, but I think he gives us a core way to look at who we are in the context of the family. And he's the one who said, it's not enough to know yourself, now we must know ourselves in the context of our families. Some of you who heard me last year at Eastern Washington could either take a break for 15 minutes or maybe you want to have a review. But for the next 15 minutes, I'm going to briefly share with you Murray Bowen's concept of how a family system functions. Murray Bowen talks about 2 basic forces that drive every system: the need to be separate and the need to be close. Whether one is an Easterner or a Westerner, whether one is male or female, These two forces or needs are constantly in operation. Now, of course, you will notice that in Western society, closeness has been most associated with females, or as separateness with males. Although this is gender related, I do not believe it's gender specific. We all need to be separate and to be close. But these two dynamic forces are always in tension. They are opposites. So they're always going to create for us some anxiety. Now, in order to deal with this anxiety created by the need to be separate, to have mastery, to make an impact on the world, to have control, and to deal with closeness, to engage someone, to be connected, to be attached, we can reduce that anxiety by going to extremes. If I have the fear of being separate, I tend to go to the extreme of emotional fusion. Emotional fusion is when two people get so close together, you can't tell where one begins and ends and the other begins and ends. Where one's responsibility begins and ends and where the other person's responsibility begins and ends. In fusion, there is seldom the word I. People who are fused talk about we. We're now going to take our bath. Or often the expression you. You never hang up your clothes. You always come home late. You. There is a lot of blaming because there is no accepting of responsibility. A couple other examples. I had a client who said to me, she was so fused with her husband, she said, "Pete, when I die, my husband's life is going to flash before my eyes." Another client said to me, "When I got married, I disappeared." I remember a phrase Murray Bowen used once with a person he was training. This therapist was being very, very empathetic with the client, too much so. And Murray Bowen said, "Can't you listen to him without licking him?" Or you may remember the play Mass Appeal. The elder priest, Tim, is an abused child. And he's constantly giving the people what they want. And at the end he says, "I'm simply been your little wind-up doll priest." These are examples of fusion. People have little separateness, so they clump together in one emotional mass. Now, if we have trouble in being close, we tend to go to the extreme, which is called emotional distance. Sometimes it's called cutoff. And sometimes people call fusion enmeshment. In distance, one is so objective, so dogmatic, so opinionated, that one cannot permeate this person's boundaries. It's like talking to the four walls. This is the person who is too certain of one's own ideas and opinions and thoughts. There is very little emotionality. As opposed to folks who are into fusion, where there is too much emotionality, and therefore there is little objectivity. Now, these are extreme positions in response to these two forces that are operative in our life. Now, at certain times, anywhere along the continuum would be an appropriate place to function. There are times when fusion is appropriate. Sexual intercourse is a time for fusion. Certainly want to be too objective at that moment nor to be emotionally cut off. It doesn't work. Or you go to a football stadium, this big playpen, and you get infused with the action. You bring your rattle and your horns, you dress up costumes, you may wear mascara, and then you turn to pre-verbal communication. And you all get wrapped up into the action of the football game. That can be appropriate fusion. There can be times when the best thing you can do for yourself is to emotionally cut off and to be distant. To get a hammock and some Lutheran libation and forget about the rest of the world. No functioning position becomes dysfunctional unless it's too extreme, or you get stuck there. and there's no flexibility or resiliency. Either you become too extreme in your functioning, or you remain a functioner only in that capacity and find it difficult to move along the continuum. Now let me say a minute about separateness. How do I get my separateness? I have to make I statements. I feel, I want, I believe, I think, I hope. Because you and I are individuals of agency, we can say I. It's not selfishness. If I am to be separate, I must take I positions. I will do this. I will not do this. A person who has the capacity to define him or herself will always have clear goals. In fusion, people have very fuzzy and vague goals. They're kind of all mushed together in one clump. And they believe in happiness and peace and security and positive thoughts and things like that. But when I am separate, I have a clear direction. Sailors say that if they are sailing and do not have a destination, they cannot tell the difference between a good wind and an ill wind. One must have clear goals. Murray Bowen also said, one cannot self-define, self-differentiate from others if one does not have a core system of values and beliefs. If you simply do not have some Weltanschauung or philosophy or way of viewing the world, how can you define who you are going to be? Let me talk for a moment then about closeness. The way I like to talk about closeness is in terms of an infant and the primary caregiver, the primary love relationship. There are five major ways that the primary caregiver and the child form the ties and have bonding and attachment. Number one is through play. You best get to know your spouse, your children, other people through play. In fact, if you cannot get close to somebody through play and ecstasy and spontaneity, you only have one other choice on how to get close to somebody, and that's through hostility. And unfortunately, there are people who are raised in families, and there are families who perpetuate this. The way they stay close is through hostility. I had a pastor who was in his second marriage. She was in her third marriage, and they wanted to make this marriage stick. But they came in like two cannons. I couldn't do therapy because I couldn't make an intervention. And I said, why don't you save $80 an hour and do this without a spectator? I can't do therapy. No, we want this one to work. Second and third session. Well, I did something I hadn't done for a long time. I tape recorded their conversation. And I let them listen to the cannons firing. He had been verbally and emotionally abused by his father. So the minute that his wife got into critical parent, he withdrew, he distanced. And of course, the minute he distanced, she loaded the guns up with heavy artillery for the next shot and went after and pursued him. Because people who are fusers and pursuers often pursue and fuse by being critical. Some people only know how to get close to you by criticizing you, being hostile with you, because that's what happened in their family of origin. They didn't know how to play. It may not feel that these people want to get close to you, and you may feel estranged from them. But people always feel that they're connected to you if you're thinking about them. And of course, when people criticize you and chase you with hostility, they get in your brain cells. They're connected. So the church that plays together stays together. And we can think of that in terms of liturgy as being somewhat playful, and other circumstances when people come together in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Play helps us to let our boundaries down, to transcend ourselves, and to get close in a safe way. Secondly, people get close through touch. No touch, no life. What the value of touch is, the child born into the world has no capacity to distinguish one thing from another thing. For the child, everything is one big whole ball of wax. The child does not have the capacity to set things apart and to differentiate. So one family therapist says you really can't talk about just a child. You need to talk about a mo-child, using a play of words on mother and child, or the word chother. Because for the child, mother is me and I am mother. My hunger and mother's nipple are the same experience. The child has no capacity to make distinctions. By the way, clergy who do not know how to distinguish between their professional role and their personal role, I call churtors. They're just like infants who cannot separate from their mothers. Or clercons. Another way to play a little words that they cannot differentiate. All right, touch. The child gets this experience that there's something out there that's not me, and it's by kinesthetic vibrations. That's the child's first experience. Something out there that's not me, and it comes through touch. And yet at the same time, touch provides what? Closeness. We can be supported and held together. Because in true closeness, there is always what? Two separate people, yet they are connected. They don't give up their otherness to be in communion. Third thing is mirroring. And I love this one. Because in mirroring, well, let me go back 1 minute to touch. If you look at Genesis 1, there is a total undifferentiated setting. It is chaos. It's like the newborn. It's not until God separates the heavens from the earth, the day from the night, the land from the sea, that there's order. There simply cannot be order without definition and classification and differentiation. Adam has the same problem in Eden. Everything is generic. There are no name tags. There are no monogram sweaters. So Adam says this will be horse and this will be cow and that will be orange and this will be red. Setting order in the world by naming, classifying. And really what helps a child to mature is to gain that capacity now to name after touching. That's why talking often becomes a way for adults to touch one another as well as to do it kinesthetically. Now let's go back to mirroring. The primary caregiver's face is a mirror for the child. When the child looks into the face of the mother and sees sadness and grimaces and pain and anger, the child says, "Ah, I caused mommy pain." Because what do children do? They believe they cause everything in the world. They blame themselves, therefore, also for everything that happens in the world. Or if the child looks into the face of the primary caregiver and sees lightness and brightness and joy, the child thinks what? Ah, I give mommy pleasure. So what do people see when they look into your face? What kind of feedback does your face become? What kind of a mirror? And there are all kinds of biblical examples of how our Heavenly Father's face becomes our mirror. And so the psalmist and the prophets keep talking about, "Oh Lord, how long will you hide your face from me? Do not take your presence from me. The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face to shine upon you." And so when we look into our Heavenly Father's face, we see a face which says to us, "You are my sons and daughters, in whom I am well pleased." The mirror of God's face. Without that mirroring, proper, adequate mirroring, the child grows up extremely confused and closeness is hampered. A fourth thing, contradiction. The child must know that mother has her needs and her interest and cannot be totally devoted to this little narcissist called an infant. And that there needs to be some separateness so that mother too has her rights and her prerogatives. And that is so important to closeness. Closeness is not to be totally embraced in one another. It is to allow for the separateness, and that separateness draws together, and they enjoy one another and then can withdraw from one another. The irony is, the greater the degree of separateness you have, the greater the intimacy you will experience. Because you can let down your boundaries and get close to another person. You can then pull back from that other person and retrieve those boundaries and reestablish them. But in fusion, you don't have that possibility. You know, you find two people in love, and they're in fusion. The romantic stage is fusion. It's blindness. It's craziness. That's why I never put too much stock in premarital counseling. You can't say much to two psychotics. But once the temporary insanity passes, then you can get some differentiation. Now the fifth thing is feeding, nurturing. In our minds, there is this formula, food equals love. Our first experience of caring is through food. Think of it, companion, kumpane. My companion is someone with whom I share bread and food. Or the wedding ceremony is bracketed by the rehearsal dinner and the wedding reception. The way to a man's stomach, or the way the man's heart, is through his stomach. The Eucharist. Feeding equals love. So when two people fall in love, they eat and they drink together. Very primitive, instinctive way to solidify themselves. Some of the things that create closeness. Now, where is the difference between someone who is close and someone who is fused? And here's the key word to remember, sameness. In fusion, there is the insistence that everyone must be the same. You must think the way I think, feel the way I feel, do the things that I do. And many organizations, many groups tend towards fusion because they want sameness. And they are threatened by separateness and otherness. The key word to remember, what's the difference between when I'm defining well who I am and I'm over-defining who I am? And the key word there is to be too certain of what you think. To be too sure of your own certitude. Okay, this is the basic paradigm that people use for family systems. Now, there are other ways to look at it from other theorists, but this is Murray Bowen's basic theory. Now, unfortunately, Murray Bowen has called this centerpiece self-differentiation, and he has been criticized by many feminists. But Murray Bowen does not mean that if you are a separate individual that you are a Lone Ranger or a John Wayne or a non-feeling person. Maybe a better phrase would be being separate together. Somehow to catch the two belong to one another. Without the one, you can't have the other. But we also know that what we try to do with our children is to get them to be a self, to stand on their own two feet, to have some power. We enable them to separate. In fact, the word self comes from the word se or se'u, which means to set apart, from which we get words like succeed and segregate. But the word self also becomes the basis for words like gossip and sibling. which talk about connected people. So when I'm using the word self, I'm using that in terms of that which can be separated out, but yet can be returned to the whole. And what does the word relationship mean? The word to relate means to carry back. And what do you carry back? You carry back that which has been separated out back to the original community or whole. So you can't be a self apart from community. And you cannot have community apart from having good selves. All right, let's take some questions. Anyone? Comments before I go on? Yes. You're just impermeable. You will not listen to anyone else. You have the world, you know, it's this way. You do it your way, I'll do it God's way. It's just... And there is very little emotion in it. Highly dogmatic, highly opinionated. Too objective. Yes. In terms of the distancer, well, let me tell you something about what the distancer needs. The distancer is so certain because his identity depends upon it. The distancer always gets his or her identity over against someone else. The person here is in opposition. The person here is trying to get too much identity by relationship, gets too tucked in. You may have come across a few folks who always need enemies, always need adversaries, need someone to give a negative identity to so they can get a what? Positive identity. That also is part of the distancer. Gets identity over against. And we can do that at times ourselves very easily. It is possible for two people to become emotionally fused and form an emotional system based on fusion, and then to be emotionally distant or cut off from the rest of the world or from other relatives or neighbors or whatever. Yes. Let me say one thing about the person who distances, though. The person who distances from primary people in life is as dependent as the person who is fused. See, these are highly dependent stages out to the extreme, because this person is dependent upon other people over against whom he or she gets his identity or her identity. That's dependency, as much as it was if two people are here in a codependent and dependent relationship. It could also be emotional cutoff or distance, correct. It could be used at either end. Criticism can be healthy. You know, 95% of criticism is carping. 5% is probably helpful. Unless you've had a different experience than I've had. I'm granting you otherness. I'm talking about mirroring, I think, is very helpful. And the mirroring doesn't necessarily always say that you're wonderful. The mirroring may also show you flaws and dark spots and blindness and so forth. And that feedback would be appropriate. Yes. Well, the Murray Bowen theorists use the word fusion. Other system theorists use the word enmeshment. They carry some of the same connotation. Of course, the different theorists argue about how they're different. I'm not too worried about how the I is dotted. Okay. Because you got to remember, self comes from the word seh, which means to be separate. I can still be separate from the relationship even though I'm in the relationship emotionally. I still can get some distance. For instance, I'll take a client that I have. She is a pastor's wife in her mid-30s. When she was 3 years old, her uncle would pick her up and rub her against his penis and masturbate himself. Did this for 4 or 5 years when he would come visit. She was just horrified when his uncle came. Now, for a child, you've got to remember that boundaries are so weak and porous and unshapen and formed. And then when an adult invades and violates and impinges on those boundaries, what that does to the sense of self. There's very little sense of self there. Little separate. And no wonder she's having problems now in adult relationships and needs to work on that. Still have a self, could still have a self, and not be aware of it. Okay. Now, you did raise a good issue, and that is that Eastern cultures, as well as feminine, tend towards the closeness and the associational, as opposed to Western society and the masculine, to this side. What I'm claiming, and I'm buying this in terms of Murray Bowen, is this still becomes a part of the double dynamic of life. Each one is beginning or starting at a different point. Okay. Now, what I'm going to do in the second presentation is use the same paradigm and talk about spirituality and different shapes and forms of spirituality related to this diagram. Okay? That's fusion. It's fusion. That's a very symbolic thing, and what you're talking about is that we have perpetuated fusion. Yeah. I have some quotes here. I'm running out of time, so I don't have too much time to talk about it. But they're from Rainer Maria Rilke, who is one poet that writes about this a lot and writes about it well. And if I can find them real quickly here, I'll read them to you. But they're very, very helpful. Any other questions while I'm looking up this? Yes. Go ahead. Correct. Okay. If I could draw this with some dimension to it, I would have an elliptical circle going this way rather than flat against the board. That this is a continuum, fusion with distance. And there's simply two ways opposite ways to deal with the double tension we have in life of being separate and close. Some people will choose to cut off and be distant. Some people will choose to fuse. And this usually depends upon the family of origin. And sometimes people who have been highly fused will eventually totally cut off to deal with the problem they had here in fusion. They're two opposite responses, both dependent, to deal with separateness and closeness. Because in cutoff, I get my identity over against somebody else. I may not be aware of it. I mean, the rebellious teenager, that's a redundancy. The person who goes way over here is still highly dependent upon parents over against whom to get the identity. It's still dependency. And whether you go here in fusion, you're still highly dependent upon the other. This is from Rainer Maria Rilke. Once the realization is accepted that even between the closest human beings, infinite distances continue to exist, a wonderful living side by side can grow up. If they succeed in loving the distance between them, which it makes it possible for each to see the other, whole and against a wide sky. And he says somewhere else that two lovers always grant each other breath and space and distance. In love, two solitudes protect and touch and greet each other. So what we've often thought of as love in the church has been high fusion. And we know from studies of families that most dysfunctional families are families that are highly fused, where there are poor boundaries. Alcoholic families, abusive families, incestuous families. Because in these families, there will always be violations of boundaries. People will be in each other's psychic space. When there is a distortion in the boundaries, there's a distortion in the space. There was another question back here. The apples do not fall far from the tree, to use a local expression here with all the apples around. The sins of the fathers are visited upon the children of the third and the fourth generation. I like the more poetic way Ezekiel says it. The fathers have eaten the bitter fruit and the children's teeth are set on edge. There is this generational transmission. And what is one of the functions of a family but to carry on tradition? Correct? Isn't that one of the functions of families, to carry on tradition? And that's why we find that individuals who have been married to alcoholics and divorced, 85% will remarry alcoholics. We keep restaging it. I don't know whether or not you accept Freud's idea, but he talks about the repetition compulsion, which is simply says we restage that which we haven't gotten resolved. And we restage it till we get it right. Now, that's very creative. Very creative. But it's also potentially extremely destructive, especially if we keep getting stuck there and can't make a change. And more than likely, we repeat what happens in our families. Now, if you come out of a highly dysfunctional family, that dysfunction will continue unless there's an outside intervention, because the family is blind to it. The family can't see it, and part of the whole denial system that goes on. Or, you know, you think of Old and New Testament history. It is God constantly making intervention into the dysfunctioning of his creatures, and in which we call sin. And unless there is that intervention, there is no hope that we would go on and repeat and repeat and repeat as being good. That each can be independent and yet make contact with each other. Well, you know, this is the goal. And we all probably imagine we're there, but that's not true. But this is the ideal that we approximate to some degree. Oh, okay. But again, like I said, any functioning position along this continuum could be appropriate at any particular time. even an extreme. But it becomes dysfunctional when you get stuck there and it's too extreme. So when a father simply abuses a daughter in incest, that's pretty extreme, isn't it? No boundaries. There's going to be distortion. There's going to be dysfunction. We know, for instance, that 95% of prostitutes have been sexually abused by their fathers or uncle or some relative. We know that almost 95% of those who have multiple personality disorder have been sexually abused. By the way, I saw a cartoon the other day, and a client had gone to a psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist says, "Why did you discover you had multiple personality disorder?" And a client said, "Oh, I discovered it when I was in group therapy, and I discovered I was the only one there." All right, you're asking, what has society done in this whole process? Murray Bowen has a principle we toss about, societal regression. And he believed that during this period of great change and crisis and cultural changing from one cultural epoch to another that we're in right now, is we're going through a societal regression. And when that happens, you'll tend to get greater fusion. And when in fusion, you're going to get people highly reactive to one another, which means they will cross boundaries. I remember in January when I went to work with Ed Friedman, it was just when the Gulf crisis was beginning. And he said, it was the first day we all had a ride, and he said, you know, you realize that Saddam Hussein is a bastard. He has no father, and he was raised, he had a father, but was never knew his father. He was raised by father's brother, etc. And he said, you know, George Bush was raised by an autocratic father who he could never please. I wonder why we're at war. You see, this is a principle of family systems. Any anxiety not resolved in primary relationships will be played out in other relationships. If it doesn't get played out in the primary relationships between spouse and child, between your parents, etc., it will get played out in other places. What do? You restage it to get it right. And any time anyone over-focuses on you, or you overfocus on someone else, it's almost a guarantee the anxiety is not in that relationship, it's in another relationship. And unfortunately, pastors get all excited sometimes when folks are really after their job or want to get rid of them or something, and they get very anxious about this overfocus. Recognize it's really not with you. It lies in another relationship. It's almost foolproof when someone is overfocused or you're overfocused on them. It's not in that relationship, it's somewhere else. Okay. Yes. Oh, over here where they're extremely distant. He lives in New York. She lives in Los Angeles. Yeah. Or they can live in the same house in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, and there is just very little emotional give and take. And the children too, correct. And you will get a lot of folks that just become solo individuals, individualists, loners, etc. And you also have to remember that you also have some people here who are distinct in today who lived in abusive fused families in the past. To get close to someone is painful. Therefore, I will not put myself in a position to be hurt like that again. It was very painful. I will simply shut it down. But see, one has not resolved that relationship when you're in distance. I send all my clients that I can back home to talk to mom and dad, brothers and sisters. I mean, that's where it began. It all didn't just fall out of the heavens. It had a format. And they are terrified. But I know there's an old statement, when you can tell your mom and dad anything, you don't need to go to therapy anymore. So I'm just trying to save him some money. Yes.
Am I going past my time here, or am I just not been making it with you folks? Pardon? Is time finished? Okay. Pardon? Time's up. Okay. I'll go with you personally, all right? One-on-one? Okay. Thank you.